You are for a drink? Do you want to get yourself a drink before we get going?
Yes.
Yeah?
Sorry, I farted.
Hello and welcome to episode 25 of The Conversation. Number 2, number 5, put them together, don't just get 7, get 25. Or correct. 52, correct. But we're not that far yet, so let's not get ahead of ourselves. As always, my name is Alan Porter.
I'm Tom Hutchison.
Welcome, how are you?
I'm good, yeah, it's been a long week.
It has. After the furore of the...
The Royal Baby. Whose name we officially know now.
Yeah.
But let's not talk about that.
I think we said enough about that last week. But yeah, it's nice to know that everything's going well or not. It's nice to know that everything is as it was.
Tickety-boo.
Let's just say tickety-boo. So, yeah.
What you want to talk about, Alan? Come on, get to point, innit? I ain't got time.
Interesting side story. When I was learning to drive, there was a Chinese girl who like was the other sort of...
Are you suggesting that was a Chinese accent?
No. It was just funny when you were saying about time. She was a Chinese girl that I would... who would pick me up, like it was in the lesson before me, and then we'd get driven around, and then like we'd go back to her house, sort of thing. This sounds sexual, it's not. And then like she'd park, and then like I'd get in the driving seat, and the instructor would let me go away.
Yeah.
And like the instructor was saying, like, oh, and I'll meet you, at, blah blah blah, this time. And she actually said, I don't know what time is. As in some kind of like existential like moment of clarity, like I don't know what time is, Bernie. I don't know what time is.
Yeah, so, she had a Hawking moment.
Yeah,
she?
Absolutely. Yeah.
What is time? Where are we? What is it all about? why am I talking like this?
Yeah, yeah. No, your head on a kind of 45 degree angle. Yeah.
I'm talking with my head stuck to my shoulder.
That's almost a little bit African. I'm talking.
Why am I talking like this?
Yeah. So yeah, that was that story. I think.
Is that a little bit racist?
Racist. Who knows? In the space age, the space year 2013. I want to talk about initially. This is obviously something that you say, obviously, but this is something that you brought up earlier on about the state of cinema. Now, I obviously don't want to talk about films per se, because
per se,
because this isn't a review podcast. That is Scattershot, a podcast featuring me and young Mr. Colin Briscoe.
Well done.
Available.
Get it on iTunes now.
Yeah, get it on iTunes. If you haven't subscribed, please do. It's a fantastic show.
Yeah, you've been cheating on me, haven't you?
I have
with
been
another
cheating.
Boy.
Yeah,
how's that going? All right,
it's excellent. Yeah, really well.
Yeah,
yeah, good listenership.
It's not what I've heard. No, I'm joking.
You haven't even listened to it.
Yeah. I heard the first one.
Yeah,
I'd give it a 4 out of 10.
Nice.
It was good.
We're going to get some guests on that show as well. So young Mr. Hutchison here may enter the fray as well as some other people that we've got lined up. So we'll get some regular guests.
Yeah, I'll drop him.
And hopefully we're going to get some other guests on the conversation as well at some point. So I know you've had 25 episodes or 25 and a bit so far of me and Tom, and we'll get some other opinions into the fray as well.
But really, there's only two you need.
Yeah, there's only two you want.
And then ain't ours.
Yeah, yeah.
That's Richard Keys.
Yeah.
The other guy, Andy Gray.
Andy Gray, yeah.
Did you smash that or what?
Yeah. Do you see the size of that slut? Fucking hell.
For our foreign listeners, they will have no idea what that's about.
No, not
don't
at
worry.
All.
Don't worry yourself. Yeah. It's a minor tabloid story from last year, very British based. Yes. Anyway, so the state of cinema.
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
In what context? How are we talking about this?
Well, When you said it to me, because I mean you suggested that as a concept, and I was, you know, it piqued my interest, because I think there's lots of things to take from that as a conversation point. I mean, I think the main point at the moment is currently the kind of sort of backlash towards the 3D thing.
Yeah.
Now, when it first came in a big way, I mean, you're talking about your Avatars, and that kind of thing. Around that era, so we're talking about 3 years ago, when that film specifically was released, because I mean that pushed the envelope as far as theatres having to have this kind of technology.
Yeah, the 3D was amazing in Avatar.
Oh yeah, it still is. I think it's still yet to be beaten.
Yeah, a lot of films are 3D. I mean, even recently they put G.I. Joe 2 back a year so that they could 3D it up.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that did anything.
I think there may have been other issues around that, but
maybe they had refilmed bits, I don't know.
I think there was normal shitty issues with it. I mean, by all intents and purposes, it's actually a fairly decent film. It's quite fun.
Much better than the first one, yeah.
I like the first one.
Because it's got The Rock in it, and this needs to be a podcast on its own. The Rock is the saviour of the cinema, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Anything he's in, it makes it 100% better. He should have had 15 Oscars by now.
Yep, I'm not going to
disagree. Totally on board with that.
So, I mean, I think that initial, like, onboarding of 3D, because, I mean, if you look at it from the theatre's perspective, they can charge what we affectionately call the 3D tax, where you get the goggles and you hike up the price of the seats by, you know, a couple of quid.
More expensive.
It's more expensive. And we'll get more. And, you know, they'd hope that the 3D draw would bring in more punters and, you know, they'd sit down.
It's a fad, isn't it?
Massively. I mean, it goes around, it comes around. I mean, you think it was in the 60s and 70s, it was, you know, the
one green eye glasses and the one red eye glasses, you know, made famous in Back to the Future. There was a character that wore them, wasn't there?
Yeah.
I mean, way back then they had 3D films.
I think the main one for that was Jaws 3D.
Which came
with the red and the stereoscopic glasses, as they know.
But a much more basic version of the modern day 3D, which is actually pretty damn good.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean,
the glasses are far better.
Yeah, and it's a technological advance. Yeah. It's rather than like
but
a simple.
But it's still
trick.
The same theory, right? It's still the same. One eye sees one thing, the other eye sees another, and then you kind of put it together in a 3D image.
No, it's completely different to that. What you're saying there is the stereoscopic 3D, which is it's the same sort of thing you used to get in comic books when you were a kid, where you had the red lens. And you could make glasses from like Quality Street wrappers, that sort of thing.
Yep.
And that's basically tricking your eye into seeing one image and another image through different coloured ink, essentially.
Yeah, they're knocking other bits out of your vision so that when you put them together with different eyes, it gives it a kind of 3D-ism.
But in a sense, and in essence, you're just tricking your brain.
Yeah.
Now, with... as you see it now, the sort of stereoscopic 3D, what you have is there's different layers to the image. So you get a foreground, a background, a foreground, middle distance, and a background. And the glasses, there's two different types. There's active shutter, which is where basically the lenses essentially flicker to only show you those ones. Those layers.
I didn't know you knew so much about this. Yeah,
I know a lot better than like Henry's cat. And the other ones that you get, which are like the sort of the standard, also known as real 3D. Basically are graded so that you see a certain amount at a certain time.
Okay.
And that's the one, they're obviously the cheaper ones. They just look like...
Well, they're standard. The ones you get for a pound in the cinema,
standard
right? You can
Wayfarers.
Throw them away after if you
yeah,
want.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Standard Wayfarers, and they're better, I think.
The problem with 3D for me is you have to wear glasses. I mean, it's all right if you wear glasses anyway. Well, actually, it's not all right if you wear glasses, because as a person who used to wear glasses before a laser eye treatment, I had to wear glasses, and then I had to wear 3D glasses over the top. Mm. I was literally four eyes sitting in a cinema.
Six.
Six if you can count my actual eyes.
Yeah.
And it was uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah.
And now that I don't need to wear glasses, and I'm having to put 3D glasses on, I don't mind doing it because I've worn glasses in the past for hours on end, but I still get the kind of achy nose bit, the bridge of the nose. I don't want to do it. Just stick a film on, stick me in front of it.
Especially with a deviated septum.
Yes, exactly. And the massive gag.
Yeah.
I just want I want to sit down and watch awesomeness, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because
yeah.
I got my perfect eyesight now. Yeah. I don't need no fucking glasses.
You don't want anything to
don't
melt.
Don't remind me of the bad days.
I don't want my eyeballs melted. I want them to be seduced.
But, I mean, personally, I've moved away from 3D. I'm really not bothered about watching it. If there's films in 3D and it's in 2D, I probably prefer now to watch it in 2D. Because at the end of the day, I just want to see it on the screen as it's meant to be.
See the film, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I don't want to faff around with glasses. Because even those glasses, the real D3D ones, whatever they are, they don't give you a perfect vision of it, because they have the lines in them, right? And it's not a perfect view.
That's how they work.
That's how they work,
That's why with real D, your optimal viewing position is rock dead centre.
Right.
About halfway down the cinema.
Right.
Because you're at the right distance in the right place. If you're off to the side, and you know, as I'm sure you know, my preferred place in the cinema is if you've got a three-tiered approach, I like to be on either of the wings on the edge. So not like on the right edge.
Just in case you have a massive need for a shit and you've got to run.
Well, yeah. I typically do need to have a wee every 30 to 35 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. Well, me too. It's popcorn and massive Coke. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Popcorn, massive Coke. Popcorn, massive Coke. Oh, shit, I need a piss. It's only
exactly.
10 minutes.
Yeah, it's not even into the trailer yet.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's kind of my thinking about it.
And of course, you're not getting the optimal image then.
Well, I say that. I've never really suffered from it.
Have you ever been absolutely wowed so much by a 3D film that you go, do you know what, that was worth the extra money and I would do it again, I'm a complete convert?
Prometheus was
in the cinema, yeah.
Yeah, I think that was the best looking film I've ever seen. And
but was it still not the best looking film regardless of the 3D? Was the 3D that much better, you think?
Truth be told, I've not seen it since then. I've had it on Blu-ray since the day it came out and I still haven't seen it.
One of the best things they say about that film, whatever you think of it, I personally really like the film, a lot of people are not sure or don't like it, whatever, is the visuals are stunning.
Yeah,
I don't
think
anyone disagrees, the visuals of that film are amazing.
Yeah, someone actually told me that like a friend of mine, well, Colin from Scattershot, said that Prometheus was the best looking film he's ever seen, and you know, obviously I trust his opinion implicitly on these things, so I couldn't wait to see it, and I thoroughly agree with him. I mean, I love the look of Ridley Scott films. He's got such a such a rich idea of how to build a world. Mm-hmm. And I mean, incidentally, just as we were off air just a second ago, we were talking about The Last of Us, and that's a good example as well of world building. Mm-hmm. Where the world looks lived in rather than just, you know,
it's not a set,
it's all shiny buildings. Like for instance, the recent Total Recall remake or a remake of the film did that quite well. It looked like a world that had been lived in rather than
I really enjoyed that film.
Yeah, it was okay.
I saw that in the cinema and I really enjoyed it.
In 3D?
No.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure I didn't.
Yeah, but getting back to the point, the Prometheus was in 3D, and that was the sort of thing where I went, fuck, you know, this is a technology, this has to come on leaps and bounds. Because genuinely, I think the last film I saw at the cinema in 3D was Jaws 3D, not when it first came out, because I would have been about 3 D. But it was during a run at the Prince Charles Theatre where they did a retrospective of all the Jaws films, and I like them, so I went and saw it. But that's kind of a thing that I think now that there's a backlash towards it because it's not novel anymore. It's not and to be fair to the theatres, it's not as expensive as it once was.
Yeah,
I think the glasses have gone down in price if you need them at all, and the actual films themselves are not as, you know, not as expensive to go to, and I think people are just, you know, aware of inflation anyway, so that's fine. But I mean, do you feel that there's another experience there for you, like not counting 3D? Do you think that there's something else? I mean, we've spoken before of when we went to see The Dark Knight.
No, on IMAX.
It wasn't The Dark Knight.
It was Mission Impossible.
We went and saw Mission Impossible 4. I saw The Dark Knight Rises. Sorry, on IMAX. That was the first like proper film I saw at IMAX that was shot in IMAX.
Mm.
And I think IMAX is the primo format for anything.
It was amazing when we saw, I've never been to an IMAX before, when we saw Mission Impossible 4 in IMAX, when they do the full screen, the size of 9 buses or something
like that. I think it's like 3 high by 4 wide sort of thing.
It's jaw-droppingly massive,
and it's as clear as you are.
You can pick people out on the streets from an aerial shot, you know, as practically space. For me, cinema is all about going, getting a bucket of popcorn as big as your face, a big Coke, and then sitting there and watching a huge screen with the sound just blasting at your ears. That's cinema for me, yeah? I don't care about the 3Ds and the silly things like smell-o-vision and stuff. I've experienced that at kind of Disneyland and things.
Mm.
And, you know,
all right, don't rub it in.
You know what I mean? Yeah, Disneyland in my mind. Yeah, no, all I want is just give me a big fuck off screen, which is awesome. All they can do for me right now is just make it more high definition and just more, you know, more lifelike. And do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I don't really need any more than that. They'll put cinema. I'm sold on cinema. I've been for years. I've been since birth.
How much does the audience factor in for you? Would you rather the audience wasn't there?
I think we've collectively, we have actually been to films where we literally, there's no seat left. I'm sure we've been to films
both
together. And also been to movies where there's literally no one else in the cinema. It doesn't bother me. I mean, maybe in like a comedy, if it was a really funny comedy and you're surrounded by a load of people laughing, you get into that kind of laugh out loud, maybe a bit more. But it really doesn't factor into my personal enjoyment. Mm. I think it's such a personal experience because each individual person in that audience will, if it's a decent film, read it differently or take what they like out of it or not.
Mm.
And that can be completely different from everyone else. Well, so it's a very personal thing.
Yeah, it's very... I think it depends where you are as well. I mean, for our international listeners, for our friends in America, I know that, and I've never been to an American theatre, but I know that over there the audience is a factor very massively. Like, they get invested. And it's like, woo, yeah, okay. Come
on. We've seen it on cam jobbies, haven't we?
Exactly. Whereas over here, like, if you make a single sound, someone's going to hit you in the head with a brick.
Yeah.
And that person will be me.
It's just not British, is it?
No.
You whoop and yell.
No, exactly. You keep quiet. And, you focus on the entertainment that your peers are paid for. For me, audience, I'd always rather there not be an audience there.
I'm kind of more that way, I think, as well.
If there was, I like being there when it's only me. I mean, I've been.
It feels more like it's your little thing, then, doesn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. I mean,
you're in a dark room. You're kind of pretty much on your own. You're watching a film that you're really looking forward to watching, hopefully, and you know, it excites you, and you come away thinking that was fucking awesome.
The first time I saw The Exorcist at the cinema, which was would have been in 1990, I'm going to say 7.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, 1998, because I was at college. Because I'd seen it before a few times. I've never really, like, I wasn't a massive fan of it, but South Wilford Cinema had it on.
Right.
I think it might have been like the 25th anniversary of it, sort of thing. And I went, I had a free period at college, and I thought, fuck it, I'm going to go to the cinema. Just on a whim, because I was of the mind at the time where I kind of did what I liked.
Yeah.
And I went and saw The Exorcist, and I absolutely, it just blew me away. Just being in a cinema on my own, I sat dead centre in the middle of the theatre, like primo position. And I was literally the only other soul in there. The only soul in there, and it was me. It was my showing, and I sat there in front of a really decent cinema, and watched a bona fide classic. And it was a totally different experience. And I've seen it since with an audience in like at the Stratford Picture House. I saw it with it was a big remastered sort of thing. Oh, look, this is the first remastered showing of this remastered print sort of thing, with the deleted footage inserted into it, like, properly and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And people were not as quite as vocal or energetic as perhaps an American crowd, but they were certainly invested in a certain way, as people dressed up and stuff. And again, there wasn't an empty seat in the house, and it was introduced by someone, I can't remember who it was.
Count Dracula.
Yeah. Exactly. It was no one involved with the production, but I think it was a fairly, it was someone who had something to say about it.
Kim Kardashian?
Yeah, maybe.
But you didn't have the same feeling?
No, absolutely not. I mean, it was completely different.
That might have been just how you were feeling at the time.
I still enjoyed the film. Don't get me wrong, I still enjoyed the film. But it was a very, very different experience to it.
So one thing that I love about cinema, and I think this is for most people, and why it's still such a massive deal. In fact, it's bigger than ever, isn't it, cinema, to an extent? It makes more money than ever. Is that it forces total escapism into you, yeah? If you're watching a film at home, I watched Parker at home last night, right?
Yeah.
Jason Statham film. It was crap, to be honest. Don't bother. Crap. Yeah.
Watch Payback instead, the same film.
Payback, yeah, I've seen, Mel Gibson, right?
Yeah.
Great film.
Or Point Blank with Lee Marvin.
Yeah, that was a mess, Parker.
You know they are exactly the same film. They're based on the same book.
Yeah, it's just a mess, though.
Yeah.
Jennifer Lopez might as well not be in it.
How the fuck did they remake that? Awful. Payback's amazing.
Yeah, there's so many things going on when you're watching it at home in the house that you've got the lights on generally, even if you've got them dimmed. Generally, there's interruptions and you have to pause it, and all this kind of stuff. And obviously with the baby and that, now the things going on there, you can't get into the films unless you're watching a film at 1 a.m. on your own. And even then, I don't think you've got to get up in the morning. You've got other things in your mind. When you're in a cinema, it's black. Jet black. You sit down. You're there for that. There's nowhere to go. There's no other distractions, and it forces total escapism into you. And I tend to like pretty much nearly every film I see in the cinema. Mm. To obviously grey, different shades of grey, but I very rarely come out and go, I didn't like that at all.
Yeah.
And it's because it just forces you to sit down and watch something and have no other distractions around you.
But you do love that. You do get to that opinion eventually. Do you, are you talking about as soon as you walk out sort of thing? You think, like, I enjoyed that because of the experience, or because I enjoyed the film because of the experience? Because I'm with you on that. Whenever, generally, when I walk out of films, I very rarely say, well, that was a big pile of dog shit.
There's only ever been, that was a waste of my life. Yeah,
there's,
exactly.
There's only ever been a couple of times I've ever
couple
said that.
A couple of times, yeah.
And one of them would be Jeepers Creepers 2.
Yeah.
And I think I can't...
Death Becomes Her was my one.
That's amazing.
I was about
you would have
been 10
young.
At the time. Yeah. So I didn't get it.
Passed your head.
It bored me. I wanted to see action films.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you come out, yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. When I come out first, wow, cinema, popcorn, Cokehead, yeah. And then
Cokehead has a different meaning.
Coca-Cola head, and then only later on do you go, you know what? Actually, that was a very good film, or you know, like,
yeah,
do you know what I mean? The experience is enough to make you come out excited anyway.
Yeah.
I think the state of cinema is in pretty good shape right now. I think some fantastic movies have been coming out of late. We talked in previous podcast about, I really believe it's the golden era of comic book films, for example. Yeah. You know, there's lots of good movies at the minute, and really fantastic actors and actresses out there.
Do you feel that the state of cinema, and when I say the state of cinema, I don't mean like productions in the works or films that are coming out and stuff, but the actual, the economic situation as far as theatres are concerned, is affected at all adversely by, you know, piracy?
It has to be.
Or other media as well.
It has to be, but at the same time, they seem to be a little recession-proof, a little bit... I don't feel that cinema is in a bad state in this country. I think my impression is that it's in a pretty good state. I'm sure the figures are pretty good as well. They seem to be doing very well financially.
Of course,
they're affected by pirate DVDs and all the rest of it.
I think it was on shaky ground for a while. I think people didn't know which way it was going to go. But I think you're right. It's definitely moved towards it getting better, sort of thing. That you know, that people going, do you know what, I'm not going to download this torrent that takes me, you know, takes an hour, and I get a DVD quality copy of it. I'm going to go to the cinema.
Yeah.
I'm going to get in my car. I'm going to drive there. I'm going to go with my girlfriend. I'm going to eat a big, dirty, great box of popcorn.
Because
and a massive
it's the
Coca-Cola.
Experience. You, no matter how many, you know, you get a free film illegally, and you get a dodgy DVD, and you put it in your, it's still not the same, is it?
No.
Oh, I got it free. But ultimately, I think pretty much everyone will get to a point where they go, do you know what, I really want to see this film. The hype around this film, whether X film, whatever it is, it's got me, and I really want to see it in the cinema. I really want to do the proper experience, and I think pretty much everyone comes to that conclusion at least 3 or 4 times a year, I would say
sort of
our age group, maybe. I mean, it depends on your financial situation and everything else, but we go to cinema a lot, but most people I know would go at least 3 or 4 times a year. You know, and in that case, if everyone done that, they've pretty rude health, I would have thought.
Yeah, totally.
Because they do offer a very specific experience that you cannot, even if you sell a million fake DVDs, you can't reproduce the full experience.
Yeah.
See what I mean?
Well, yeah, there's a lot to be said as well for it being an event. I mean, you know, we're probably not of the age where we could appreciate like repeat business. I've certainly not really been to see too many films more than once at the cinema. But then you think, like, girls maybe a bit younger than us would have gone to see Titanic, you know, maybe half a dozen to a dozen times.
Oh, gotcha.
Whereas, you know, I think the only films that I've seen more than once have been films that don't come on the cinema very often. I mean, I think I saw Lord of the Rings a couple of times when it was out.
Well, your Exorcist one is a classic example.
Yeah, but you know, you got to think. I saw them like 10 years apart. So it's a big difference to doing that. You know, I've seen what else have I seen a number of times? I've seen Die Hard at the cinema a couple of times.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I've seen.
See, for me, once I've seen a film at cinema, if I'll happily watch it again. I've seen plenty of films 2, 3, 4 times, but I'll watch them at home after that. I don't need that. I just don't see the point in seeing it again in a cinema.
Well, there's some films that you enjoy so much that you feel... I mean, I say you, I'm talking about me now. I feel that it's a benefit to see it in the cinema. For instance, Die Hard. I've seen Die Hard in the cinema a number of times. Now, I can quote that film off by heart, as I'm sure you can.
Yep.
If it comes on the telly.
Ho, 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 I have the detonators.
That's so wrong. It's unbelievable.
It's something like that, isn't it?
No. yeah, it, you know, I know that film off by heart, so I can. There's no surprises there for me. I'm not gonna suddenly say, oh well, maybe John McClane's conflicted here because he's just killed a man, broken his neck by pushing him down a stairwell. There's no surprises there, but for me, in that instance, seeing it with an audience is a big deal because it's not like one of those fucking like Sound of Music sing-along things. People are going, oh, the hills are alive. There's people dancing in the aisles. Fuck that noise. Like, you don't get like fat blokes in vests crawling through the air conditioning units of the fucking Odeon when you watch Die Hard. You typically only see it in repertory cinemas anyway, so it's not like you're going to go to your local cinema and see Die Hard.
Yeah.
So the audience being there, they'll cheer and laugh in the right places and they know what's going to come up, and that is an experience. Which you wouldn't have got the initial time you went there.
Yes.
You absolutely wouldn't have got it. I mean, I've seen Star Wars in the cinema, all the Star Wars films, maybe twice. I mean, one, I went and saw all six back to back in Leicester Square.
Without a pee?
No. I peed many a time. And I also skipped an entire film.
Have you heard of The Secret Cinema?
Yes.
Would that be something that would interest you?
No.
No, me neither.
No, I've heard it's very badly organised now.
What this is, oh really? What this is for our listeners out there is basically a group that will show a classic film, for example, Grease. I know this for a fact because friends of ours did this one. And it's, like you say, it's an event. So they go along, it's an undisclosed London location. I think they get told on the day where the location is. They know it is in London, for example. They'll go along, they have to dress up as characters from the film. Or certainly in the dress of the film. So in this case of Grease, it'll be 50s style Americana. And then they would turn up and they would have hired, say, a hall out or something, and they've turned it into basically the school from the film, Rydell High. And you've got actors playing teacher parts and all the rest of it. T-Birds and all the rest of it, and they get you into
actors playing cars. T-Bird's a car. Thunderbird.
No, they're the T-Birds, aren't they? The gang in it, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, sorry, I'm thinking of the Sharks and the Jets. I'm thinking of West Side Story.
Yeah,
Officer Kropke.
Maria!
Yeah.
Grease Lightning! Yeah.
Stop it, we're going to have to pay royalties in a minute.
Yeah, and then so you have a drink, and it's everyone, oh, look at all the fancy dress and all this, and then you watch the film together.
Yeah, sorry to interject. Yeah, that definitely makes a difference when you can have a beer watching the film. Yeah, definitely.
And you know, it doesn't interest me.
No,
it doesn't interest me.
No, I know somebody went to the very, very first one, which was Blade Runner, I believe.
Oh, right.
In a disused, old office space somewhere, and they had actors there, saying lines, and they're all dressed up as
androids and things.
Yeah, not Sean Young, like what's her name, the other bird in it, with all the white makeup and stuff.
Oh yeah,
and some bloke who's dressed up as Roy Batty and stuff like that.
I heard about the Shawshank Redemption one, which was apparently quite brutal, where actors were beating the hell out of inmates as
really?
Wardens.
And one of them had to get raped. Did he?
There was something like that. Yeah, there really was. There really was something like that. It was
like
quite
acting
brutal.
Out,
and
yeah.
They made all the people who attended dress up and ditch their clothes for overalls and stuff, like prison uniforms and stuff. Yeah, it was pretty hardcore.
And old Tom Hutchinson had to crawl through a river of shit.
Morland Freeman. The one thing that worries me about cinema, is that they price themselves too high eventually. You know, I mean, we've seen it with pubs. I argue that beer is too expensive, so pubs have fallen away a little bit, partly because of that reason. There's many other reasons. But
the government has control of that, but yeah.
Yeah, the tax on beer is ridiculous, right? But beer's too expensive, people don't go to pubs no more. I would worry that they get too greedy with cinema prices. If you pay full whack right now, it's a lot. Say you took a family of four, right? You paid full whack, you didn't get any kind of voucher deals or whatever, Orange Wednesdays or whatever the fuck it's called. You'll be spending 50, 60 quid just to go to the cinema.
Yeah, yeah.
Family of four, maybe.
Yeah,
that's a lot of money.
It is, yeah.
That's a hell of a lot of money. I mean, that's already too much for me. But there are these deals out there so that people can get away with it. It's cheaper, you know, on daytimes and all this kind of stuff.
If it starts dropping off, I mean, there's always the thing that they could just they could start serving booze.
Crack cocaine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of the cinemas I go to, because, I mean, as much as I go to, like, my local Odeon, or is it the Odeon? Lee Valley?
Lee Valley's an Odeon.
Yeah. I mean, I tend to go there more often than not. just to see a new release. Yeah, because I mean, it's got new releases and stuff, and it's convenient. But I like to go to places like Stratford Pitch House or the Screen on the Green in Islington, or you know, the IMAX in Waterloo and places like that.
There's one you'd love. It's an Odeon. It's their premier Odeon in the country. It's in North London. I forget where. I can't remember the name of it. But basically, you sit down. I think I've told you about this before. They serve you a meal to your chair.
I've been there. Yeah, I did a corporate there.
What's it called?
It's the View or the...
Yeah, it's got a fancy name.
The Screen. It's something like...
You're treated like you're in an airport. Yeah. There's a bar in there.
Wonderful, yeah. You have a proper meal when you're eating.
And you have a meal watching a film, yeah. And it's like really
big
good
leather,
food.
Big leather seats with nice things,
and, yeah, big leather seats, but it's also like a airplane with the kind of foldy tray over your lap, and people come up to you and whisper in your ear, oh, would you like another drink, sir?
Yeah.
What would you like for dessert, sir? It's a very strange experience.
Are you finished? I'll wipe you up.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I did watch Shame in that cinema.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you?
Very strange experience.
Did you have the tray to hide your erection after when you got to the old bill out?
Yeah. Didn't really hide it.
I definitely agree with it. I think there is other ways that they can rejuvenate it, should it need rejuvenating. I mean, you seem fairly optimistic that that's not the case.
I don't think they need to. I just think they need to keep it reasonably priced so that the everyman can go there and not go, do you know what, it's too expensive, I can't afford to go to the cinema. I'd love to, if it ever gets to that point, they've gone too far.
I do agree, but I think there'll be a natural point where it will get too expensive, just like it did with the 3D tax thing, and they'll need to reinvent it in some way, be it as you say, lowering the prices, or you know, releasing booze, or being more repertory. I think that's something that the more you might want to put your phone. That's Tom's phone, by the way. It's not on podcast mode. There we go.
Yeah.
It is. I think it's some of the more like multiplex kind of things that we talk about, like the Odeon and that, do repertory showings. Then that would be so much better, rather than showing a fucking, I don't know, like some Indian film from 2001, which, you know, four people are going to go and see, and it's audio descriptive. Like, why bother doing that when
play to your strengths, right?
Why bother doing that when you could show Aliens, which I guarantee you would be packed out. Just say, do you know what, you know, advertise the shit out of it, because everyone gets the Odeon cinemas. I think, say, do you know what, in 2 months time we're going to show Aliens, book your tickets now, they're a fiver. It's not in 3D.
Keep it cheap. Yeah.
It's a fiver, and we're gonna do like we'll show the director's cut.
You'd almost do like an EasyJet kind of thing. It's fiver now. It'll go up to £10 the month before or something.
Yeah, totally. And that's that.
Well, they're already doing that to an extent, because my TV is Virgin Media.
Yep.
Coverage. Yeah, you've got Sky, right?
I have.
With Virgin Media, what they're doing now is every month they're going to show a film, a new film. They show it a day before release in your local cinema for free, and until the tickets first come first serve. So what happens is I seem to get the emails in the afternoon. My dad gets them in the morning. Same email. He seems to get them in the morning. I don't know what's happened there.
Has he got .com and you've got .co.uk?
I have no idea what it is. Would that matter? Anyway. So for example, what was the one? It was the big Tom Cruise film recently, the alien-y one.
Oblivion. Right? I've got that. I haven't seen it yet. I'm really looking forward to watching it.
It's a good film.
Yeah,
I enjoyed it.
I like the director. So
what happened was, it comes up, Virgin send out an email, Oblivion's our film of the month. We are showing it in, you know, I don't know, 50 cinemas across the country. See, you know, get your maximum two free tickets now. You click through, and if you're quick enough, first come, first serve, you just got two free tickets, right?
Yeah.
So we got it. My dad got it because he got the email early. We went along because my mum didn't want to see it, so me and him went, right? They give you a bag of popcorn each. Yeah?
Yeah.
There you go, on Virgin, there's a bag of popcorn, sit down. You end up buying a drink, so the cinema makes a bit of money out of you. Everything's free. The film gets shown the day before it goes out on general release, so you feel like, oh, I'm seeing it for everyone else, even though it's out in 2 hours' time anyway. And what a great thing. And those cinemas, and it's always like 5-6 o'clock in the afternoon on a Tuesday or something, yeah? So it's the worst time for them to actually get people in the cinema, I presume. No one's going to go to the cinema at 5 o'clock. They usually go after work or, you know, in the afternoon.
Weekend sort of thing, yeah.
Yeah. So they fill out, they pack out a cinema, they might make £100 on drinks. And people will buy sweets as well as the popcorn that they know they're getting, yeah?
Yeah.
So everyone's happy, right? cinema gets full, they make money. Yeah. And they should do more of that.
Well, that's 100 quid they wouldn't have made otherwise for just having one bloke in there watching fucking, you know, Chipmunks 2, The Squeakquel.
Exactly.
So, okay, well, I think that's a nice place to leave that. There's plenty more scope for cinemas to do stuff. They just need to keep reinventing what they're doing on a rolling basis.
Yeah, show me some more films. I want more Bruce Willis.
Exactly. We love our Bruce. Now, one of the things that we've spoken a lot about has been not that dog barking in the background, but has been Star Trek. Now, we're not going to talk about that now, but as I said, one of the things that interested me about that in particular was the exploration factor of it. So, you know, the 5-year mission to explore strange new worlds and seek out new civilizations, blah, blah, blah. And exploration has always been something that has really piqued my interest. The sort of you know, the people who have gone above and beyond, I don't want to say the call of duty, but beyond civilization
expectations,
like society's expectations to seek out new things, be it in obviously Star Trek's fictitious sense, you know, space and the final frontier. But I mean, one of the things that I always love is explorers and people who go where no man has ever gone before. Again, I'm using the Star Trek, I'm paraphrasing, but you know, to find these things, that to be the first, really. Like, I'd like to find why that dog's barking and kick it in the fucking face.
Kick it in the nuts.
But we'll try and ignore the hound for now. So yeah, I mean, I think there's two polar opposites for exploration at the moment, talking as we are in the future, the space year 2013. We have outer space, which I think we've spoken about before. So you've got, you know, the infinite beyond, as it is, and you've got what, you know, we affectionately call inner space, which is the, you know, the macro element of our planet, be it the
minutiae.
Yeah, the deepest of the oceans, or genome.
It's easy to say that pretty much everything that needs to be discovered on this planet has been discovered, but that's not true.
That's not true at all. I wouldn't believe that for a second.
You know, the oceans. Why look outwards to the space when there's so much below the surface of the water that we haven't even touched?
I think it's true that we've discovered more visible space. We know more about visible space than we do about our deepest oceans.
Yeah,
I think that is a truism.
Yeah, there are creatures down there that are waiting to be discovered. We know that there's so many. I mean, there's always these kind of, oh, this amazing new fish has been found, and it's just like, oh, well, yeah, no, it's always been there. We just never got that far down before.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah.
Right? And God knows what's down the bottom. Do you know what I mean? There's so much, there's so much mass below where we can physically reach even right now.
Yeah.
We're decades off discovering even half of the things that are down there.
Well, I think that the person who's been furthest down, or
Jimmy Cameron, isn't it?
Yeah, Jim Cameron, who, you know, as a
Mr. Avatar.
Yeah, well, he's got the obviously he's got a lot of money, and his passion is for you know, underwater exploration.
Yeah.
And you know, he's just a phenomenally intelligent man.
Well, that's a guy who's made his money and he's actually doing what his passion, and he's now pretty much an explorer.
Yeah, totally.
You know, makes films on the side.
Yeah, much in the same way as Clive Cussler, who writes the Dirk Pitt books.
Oh, yeah.
He you know, writes a lot of his stuff is you know, his deep sea exploration is the subtext to a lot of these like grand adventures that he has. Mm-hmm. Kind of a very Indiana Jones. But he, you know, in a way that, you know, fiction inspiring life. In the books, he wrote about a like fictitious team called NUMA, which was a National Underwater and Marine Agency, I think it was. Right, I read one of those books for a while, but I could be wrong. And so, you know, funding his passion for this sort of thing and classic cars, he, you know, buys a load of classic cars and, you know, actually founds this underwater agency.
Right.
You know, at the author doing it because he wrote about something which didn't exist, and now it exists because he does that.
Amazing.
And you know, they send these people off to the deepest oceans, and they, you know, they look for stuff. I just think it's amazing that I don't think in our lifetime we're gonna know the secrets of the ocean.
No.
And it's just a
And think about all the things that are down there that could potentially, you know, cure cancer or something. You know, it's ridiculous things that these, there might be not even just like fish and sea life, but actual kind of plants, you know, or whatever they've got down there, foliage, or underwater foliage of some kind, that might be able to, you know, fight AIDS, amazing things. Absolutely amazing. They can cure things. You know, how do we know these things are yet to be invented?
Well,
and that's all on this planet. That's not even looking out to the stars.
Exactly.
And you could go even more microcosmic to that, than that, and say that, you know, some of the best and the biggest explorers at the moment are the medics and the people looking at the human body and actually what they're able to do on an ever increasing minuscule level. I mean, cancer is not the death sentence it used to be for a lot of people.
No.
Obviously, there are ones that are still incurable. Well, you know, it's all incurable, I suppose, to an extent, but they can certainly treat it to the point where you can continue to have a great life and go into remission and, you know.
It's better than it used to be, much better.
Even a generation ago, it was, you know, you've got cancer, bloody hell, I'm going to die.
But it's
not like that anymore. And in that short period of time, imagine what's going to happen in 100 years' time, you know. When our kids are great grandparents or whatever, and they'll probably still be living at 100.
Well, I mean, on that particular subject, I genuinely believe that cancer, I don't think there is a cure per se, but I think there is a like a genome somewhere that there's a binary switch somewhere in the human body,
right?
The way so that at birth, just as we said last podcast. With, you know, baby Jack when he was born, you have the vitamin D thing and you have the pill prick tests and stuff like that. I think at some point there'll be a thing where they do something, you know, it's just a genetic modification, it may even be in vitro sort of thing where they, you know, they do that and it's just like, okay, your cancer switch has been switched off. You know, and so that tiny babies like yours and mine, you know, might be able to continue. It could be an immunization to it rather than a cure, given its particular its definition of cancer. I mean, you know, you not, you know, taking the medical thing out of it, it is a term, it is a word. That, you know, that there'll be an immunization towards that sort of thing happening. I think that's probably more the development rather than the way that we have gone previously. I mean, I'm no longer a medical doctor, so I can't say.
No,
we won't go into that. It's a different podcast entirely. But going back to the deep sea exploration thing, and you're absolutely correct. The Mariana Trench is the deepest ocean in the world,
right?
In the ocean. And it is at a depth of only 10.9 kilometres.
Right.
Now, you think about that. I mean, I ran further than that last weekend. So
that's all the way down 10.9 kilometres to the bottom.
Yeah, for the very bottom.
Well, that doesn't sound a lot, does it?
No.
What's that in miles? About 6 miles?
Yeah. 6.831 miles.
Oh, right, there you go.
If I'm thinking, yeah. I'm reading this next paragraph from Wikipedia, the world famous Wikipedia. At the bottom of the trench, the water column above exerts a pressure of 1,086 bars, which is 15,750 psi, over 1,000 times the standard atmospheric pressure at sea level. So, you know, we haven't got the technology presently to properly explore that place. I mean,
because it would crush us to death, right? The pressure would just crush us as a human.
If a submarine cracked, even a microscopic amount, the pressure is so great that you'd be the size of a pea, or the size of an atom within like a microsecond.
Just all crush him.
It's far too much. And of course,
There will be technology that eventually that they'll be able to send robots and machines down there that will be able to take that pressure. And they're already doing that to an extent. Maybe not to the bottom. Or, I don't know.
Well, no, I think robots and what they call geeks. I think that that can go down there and the sort of. Like automated
submarine
things. Yeah. Like they can go down there because obviously you can build them out of like you know 4 foot thick steel sort of thing. So that's not so much of an issue. But obviously you can't really do a great deal without a human being in there to make the decisions that human beings make. And the, as much as the oceans are an absolutely fabulous untapped resource, as you quite rightly said, and you know, when Jim Caron went down there, we found, you know, these fantastic bioluminescent animals and you know, things which have this translucency which we hadn't encountered before, and they captured samples and stuff. But of course, you get up to the, by the time you've gone, I don't know, 1,000 meters up, they've just exploded because they're not used to the pressure, the lack
above,
of
yeah.
lack of pressure above.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess they explode or implode. I'm not sure. So you know, there's
just the like, reverse effect, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, kind of. Yeah, I think it's kind of like the bends, but I think there might be a where you know they naturally react to the pressure, like a it's like counterpoint pressure in a collapsed building, that sort of thing. So those I think they're called xenophores, which are, you know, the kind of the animals that can that have that sort of skeletal structure to survive at those pressures, or no skeletal structure, if you will. There's fascinating things to be found there. How much of a medical application they have, who knows?
Because obviously,
yeah, as you say, you need to have them there.
You need to have samples
to study this thing. And I still find it fascinating that we very occasionally find these areas that aren't in the deepest, darkest trenches or in space. We have these areas of, like, you know, there's little pools of African towns or something that's, you know, sitting in a rainforest that have never seen civilization, that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
We find less and less of them as we go along.
Yeah. But there always seems to still be found.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
They do. I don't know whether it's just the same tribes moving around, just chucking away their man.
You know, even history, you talk exploration, kind of Indiana Jones style almost, is there are, you know, people are still uncovering things about the past that were just forgotten, weren't part of modern knowledge. You know, it's just something that's kind of dodoed off almost.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
All of a sudden they're like, oh, right, well, you know, there were people talking in this language 1,000 years before even we realised, you know, and that changes this because of this. And, you know, suddenly the jigsaw shifts and, you know, there's still that kind of exploration that goes on. And things are being found all the time still from the past that actually have huge effects. You know. In a very simplistic way, like, oh, for example, maybe discovering that the wheel was invented on another continent before what was previously thought, you know, that's huge ramifications of what that means, you know. And that's a different type of exploration. I mean, but space is obviously still the big one, the one that everyone looks to on what's out there, and they keep finding these new planets with better telescopes that, that's an Earth-like planet, you know, they've found untold Earth-like planets now, haven't they?
Class M, I believe, is the technical term.
Yeah, which basically can sustain life, yeah?
Yeah.
What always surprises me, they seem to be ever baby-stepping their way to proving life on Mars, more in the last 5 years than ever before.
Yeah. Well, think about it. There's a fucking little truck on Mars. We put a little car
on Mars, on another planet.
On another planet that, you know, that's... I still can't quite get my head around that's a thing. And, you know...
I mean, only last year did they basically prove that there was water on Mars, which actually is a fucking mind-blower if you think about it.
Yeah, totally. Well,
you know, if you'd have said even 10 years ago, there's proof that there's water on Mars, you'd be, what are you talking about? It's always been the driest planet ever. And, you know, it just...
If I was going to name you one dry planet, it would have been the first one.
It would be Mars. Yeah. Look at it. It's red. It's dust.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just... That instantly flips what anyone's ever thought about Mars. And it's still changing to this day, you know, as these rover machines work out more and more about it. They're pretty much going to prove there's life on Mars within the next couple of years.
Well, there may have been microscopic life on Mars.
Little aliens walking around, but certainly...
No. Well, by definition, they would be aliens. But
they would be aliens. Yeah.
Once
you prove that, I think you then instantly open up the rest of the universe. It's got to be everywhere. Surely, it's got to be everywhere. If it's on our most distant, the most nearest neighbour, then it's pretty much got to be everywhere. Life.
I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. I mean, I think that by the nature of the fact that it is our nearest neighbour, and we're very much in the Goldilocks zone, and that I think that is the technical
terminology.
Yeah, where it's not too hot, it's not too cold, it's just right. So that we, and I think this is the backbone for a lot of, you know, theology and religion, where they say, you know, the chances of this rock having this specific you know, like atmospheric condition, and you know, being that distance from the sun, which, you know,
perfect heat
in the wide range of things, it's you know, just a million gazillion bazillion like chance to one that that would actually be the case, and then this happened and that happened, which formed, you know,
single. There's also the argument that life will always find a way, and even in the most extreme of circumstances, it seems to be able to thrive and change and adapt. I suspect it'll be more that way.
A theory proven in the famous documentary Jurassic Park.
Yes.
By Dr.
Life will find a way.
Malcolm. Yeah. Are you suggesting that a society made entirely of females will reproduce? I'm just saying that life will find a way. That is
So that's the next big thing, isn't it? Ultimately, I think, and what everyone would want as a global population is to explore the stars a bit more. That's the big one,
yeah,
isn't it?
I mean, I want to know more about that.
Because we know we are such a tiny part of what is a huge thing out there that you can't help but wonder. Actually, I mean, we could be a tiny pinprick compared to what's really going on, and we don't even know about it.
Well, I think we know that that is the case.
Yeah,
it's just how great. How great is the scope that we need to look at this in? Because we can, as you say, we've got technological advances that we can see, and only see the stars. We can see, you know, and we know that that's history. We know that when we look at a star, it's an expired
thing. It's two light years away. That means it's 2,000 years old. Yeah. It's in a 2,000-year-old image.
Exactly. Yeah. It's something that died X amount of years ago. Whereas, you know, the explorations close to the home, as we said, like the little pockets of civilization that have never seen stuff. Mm. Who knows that they may be more advanced than us anyway? They may, you know, be it on a moral level, be it on
on a language level,
on a language. They could have discovered a language that has four words, but yet, you know, is much more detailed than anything we have. I mean,
you could spend lifetimes and lifetimes studying things here and never learn everything about this planet, let alone everything else that's going on outside of this planet.
Yeah.
You know, the exploration is yet to begin in a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're only scratching the surface of what we know. Yeah.
How do you know? I mean, if you think about it, when, what, 1,000 years ago, when people were talking about the world being flat.
Yeah.
And then someone comes around and goes, oh no, it's round. Up until that point, everyone goes, what the fuck are you talking about? It's not round, it's flat. Look over there.
What area, obviously we won't know what the next bigger revelation like that would be, but what area would you think that would come up in next? A big life-changing, oh my God, kind of. Is it the kind of space, the life on Mars thing? Is it a medical breakthrough, you think, in some form where a human will be cloned for the first time, which will suddenly...
I don't really see that as exploration. I see that more as again,
a scientific breakthrough.
Again, going back to the documentary Jurassic Park, I think that's you know, standing on the shoulder of giants and not taking responsibility for what's gone before you. Mm. You know, a kid finding his dad's BB gun, that sort of thing. But one of the classic examples of, you know, the hunt for something, the exploration factor, is El Dorado, the lost city of gold.
Yeah.
It's something that, you know, many hundreds of people, many thousands, many millions of people, have devoted their life towards, to find this place. And I think that is the essence of exploration, in as much as the quest is much more rewarding than the find.
Yeah.
You know, searching those kinds of people who have an idea and an ideal, and they want to chase it through to some kind of fruition. That is the very essence of exploration.
Yeah.
So when you're looking for
the fun is in the chase, right?
Exactly. When you go to something like, again, going back to the likes of Star Trek or looking into the oceans, you're kind of looking for something that you don't know what you're looking for.
Mm.
You're just looking. It's speculative.
Mm.
You go looking and go, oh, I found a fossil. Oh my God, it's amazing. Like, yeah, it is amazing. You found something that no one's ever found before. Great. What is it? What does it do? Nothing. It's a fossil. it might give you some information. It might give you the cellular structure, perhaps, or you know, the
of an ancient mollusk.
Exactly. Yeah, it's always an ancient mollusk of a dirty, great, like silistic mollusk.
I now know how snails walked 15 million years.
Exactly. Look, he fell over on his side, and he had a rock fall on him,
and he had a wank,
and he died. He had a little wank.
little
snail wank.
With his little slow one,
yeah, with his little proboscis, and it all went down well, and then he died.
I'm very happy.
spurt, and yeah. Die, and get found.
Mollusk death. One day I'll be discovered in the future, and people will know how I wank.
The University of Leicester will
probably
be
when I finish
happy.
Saying this sentence.
Yeah. I mean, as much as I am fascinated with myself, and I would recommend everybody, if you are in a position to do this, please go to the Natural History Museum in London Town, in South Kensington. Please donate massively, as much as you feel that you can, and just wander around there, spend the day, take your family. It's fantastic for kids as well, and just look at stuff. I mean, obviously, there's the Elgin Marbles, which you stole, but we won't go into that. But there's a lot of like evolution there, and you know, as a dyed-in-the-wool atheist, I think it's nice to say you know the natural progression of history and of nature to go through. But it's one of those places where you go there and you appreciate that. These things didn't just fall into a fucking glass case.
Mm.
People actually went out and found these things. You see a case full of, 2,000 butterflies, different butterflies,
yeah,
with different markers, all for a specific reason, to either evade a predator or to hunt.
Yeah,
collected and catalogued.
Preserved.
And I'm standing
there. Someone's life work.
Yeah, and I'm standing there in my shorts and my flip-flops, and I'm looking at them, and I'm going, this is pretty shit. It's just butterflies. But you know, as you say, it was someone's.
Where's the bar?
Where's the bar? Yeah, yeah. Let's all go to the Natural History Museum again.
Look, fucking I'm doing it. This with my cock out.
Yeah,
yeah.
Take a piece of a dinosaur. Hey. Have that Triceratops. Yeah. You can.
Do you think he saw us?
Where's his dog? Do you think he saw us, Rex? No, everyone has a personal reaction to these sorts of things. But I think as far as exploration is concerned, going back to your original question that you asked me about 50,000 million years
ago,
I think our next big find will be part of the human condition. It'll be something, I'm hoping, is something to do with the brain.
A third eye.
The porter's eye.
The brain, unlocking the brain's potential.
Unlocking the brain's potential.
I like that one. Because we only use 5% of our brains or something stupid like that, famously, isn't it? What's the rest of it doing?
Well, there's millions of examples of, you know, human beings who can use. There's obviously the savant syndrome.
Oh yeah,
where you have people who often have fairly severe sort of, I don't want to say learning difficulties, but you know, societal issues. But they have these extraordinary abilities where they can. You know, they either have, you know, memory or, you know, some kind of artistic
bent
properties, facilities to do things. I mean,
yeah, so someone who can't, who on the surface seems unable to function in a social setting with people,
yeah,
and yet can paint the most amazing picture.
Yeah,
we've seen it with detail. They paint New York and it's picture perfect.
Yeah,
you know,
I think
to the inch.
Absolutely. I mean, the most famous of which would be Kim Peek, the famously titled The Real Rain Man, the guy that Dustin Hoffman based his performance on for Rain Man.
Yeah.
Who, you know, he had severe like character difficulties. He had severe brain damage he was born with. But yet he had severe motor skill issues, but his mind worked in such a different way to ours that because of his brain damage, it was linked in a way that we just, you know, from the hippocampus to the other parts of his brain that, you know, that we simply don't work in that way.
Mm.
That, you know, he more or less lived in the I think it was the New York State Library,
reading
on the Metropolitan Library, and he just read That was it. And he went and did talks and things like that. But his dad had to look after him. And sadly, he died very recently.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. He died of a heart attack. But they said that he read around about 12,000 books. And wow. he could remember about 99% of them word for word.
Wow.
And he'd read like a couple of hundred books a week sort of thing. And he'd open a book and his left eye would read the left page and his right eye would read the right page. And he'd just flip, 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 amazing. Flip, flip. And he'd remember it all. Like he'd used to go to universities and people would ask him stuff about like obscure baseball stats or when someone lived or something like that.
Yeah.
He was just a sponge for that information.
Mm.
And you get, you know,
that shows what the brain can do then.
Absolutely. And it might be that it's a freak occurrence, like, you know.
But surely we must all have that capacity.
Absolutely. That's it. That's what I'm saying.
He might be a freak occurrence of one in a billion.
Mm.
Human that can do that, utilize that capacity, but we must all have that ability in us.
Why not?
Yeah,
absolutely. I think you're absolutely correct. You know, there's people like I can't remember his name. I think he's Stephen something or other. As you said, the guy who can he sees a cityscape and he can just draw it. He's a British guy. He could just draw it from memory.
Mm.
Absolutely, you know, to scale, perfect.
Yeah.
You know, beautifully as well. And I'm just gonna have a quick look through.
Do you think this is the area where we're going to discover the next big thing?
Massively. Yeah. It has to
be. What humans are capable of in some form.
Because it's the absolute definition of the macro level, isn't it? As much as we can go down to the genome or, you know, the DNA of us, the actual functionality of the human being, surely that's
and the mind, which is ultimately the essence of the human being,
absolutely
is the focal point. Isn't
the mind is the mind is everything. It creates,
so unlocking the mind in a completely different form that will, you know, flip what we believe to be everything we believe to understand about it on its arse, basically.
Yeah. Well, the guy I was talking about, Stephen Wiltshire, his name is commonly known as the human camera. I think that's a really shit name.
Johnny 7 Pixels.
Yeah. A lot of these people output a high degree of, say, like musical ability as well.
Oh, they can recreate a song by ear, you know.
Yeah.
10 hours long, perfectly, or something.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
or, you know, or fill in blanks for something that shouldn't be there just purely by some sort of.
Subconscious understanding. Yeah, I know what you mean.
It's kind of like a procedural muscle memory where they, you know, the brain fills in the gaps for an area. So if they play like the start, if someone plays you the start of a piece and the end of the piece, they can fill in the middle of the piece.
Mm.
You know, it might not necessarily be as you wrote it, for instance, but that, you know, knowing how things
to bridge
work.
It. Yeah, 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 yeah.
You know, their mind can fill in the brain in a sort of puzzle level.
Mm.
And I think that's absolutely where exploration needs to go, rather than should go
on a macro
or
level.
Is going, yeah,
rather than going for the big, we can't get cross space, we should look more inwards.
Well, why? What? Who's to say that if you can make those sorts of connections in the human brain, that the person who has that level of intelligence,
if you can unlock that ability,
that person cure cancer?
Yeah,
why can't that person create a warp drive or a fucking
a form of traveling space and time or whatever?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Or some kind of scientific advance, or, you know,
well, on that level, we're barely scratching the surface within our own heads, let alone within the exploring the rest of the world and everything outside of it as well.
And if we unlock
our own potential, then everything else follows, right?
Absolutely. That's exactly the case I'm making. And I think that's where I think that should come. What about you?
I can't disagree with that. I think, you know, how can you look to the stars and everywhere else until you fully discover what we as a race are capable of? And arguably, we'll never fully understand what we're capable of. Because the minute we do what's left to do, really? I think there's always something.
Well, everything. Everything and anything.
And whatever else, I suppose, yeah. Definitely that we need to look inwards before we look outwards.
Mm.
If that's a nice catchphrase for the end of the year.
Yes,
podcast.
I couldn't have put it in a more poetic way myself.
I'd like to explore Uranus, is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, you couldn't let it lie. We ended so nicely. And he always goes for the butt. Always goes for the arse.
It's always the arse joke at the end.
Yeah. Brilliant. Well, Well, I think I would hope that that leaves our lovely listeners with something to something to comment on. Please do comment on anywhere else you think that we should explore.
Telepathically send us your emails.
Yes.
We will pick them up and unlock them in the future.
This is a time capsule on iTunes, which is probably not the best place to leave it because you can just get it straight away rather than like...
In the future, it'll be built into your head, iTunes, anyway.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Access my iTunes library through my brain. Yeah. We're in your brain right now. Hey!
Why aren't you listening to my other podcast? Okay, cool. Well, I think that's a fantastic place to leave it. And as Tom says, let's explore the inner rather than the outer at the moment. So I think that's enough from me, Alan Poulter.
Me, Tom Hutchison. We'll see you next time.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.